Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Thursday, December 19th. I'm Ray Graff. The time has come once again for another science forum. Our scientific panel has been reassembled. I YouTube the directions. They're all put together pretty much as they should be. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a science question. 800-348-2551. If you want to, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Yeah, it's the Science Forum. Your calls are coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Exciting times here on the radio. We welcome back our scientists and reconvene the Science Forum. The number to call if you have a question about anything vexing you about science, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. This is the exciting part of the show. Let's have our scientists sign in, please.
Yes. Hi, it's Barbara Brabetz here for this holiday edition. I am from SUNY Cobleskill, and I'm a biochemist.
And you're on break now, yeah?
Yes. I'd say that I am done with all but meetings.
It's very exciting.
Yes.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
That's it?
And that's
it. Are you on break?
I'm always on break now.
I love that. That's great.
And I'm Roger Giaboni, and I own Roger's High Fidelity. I'm an engineer.
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill. I'm ready to be vexed.
Well, you know what? What I love about this panel, as opposed to the other panel, we'll not be talking politics today. This is nice.
What? Politics?
No politics.
Nothing's going on.
We should do round
two
of the round table.
You're killing me. Anybody have any scientific issues they want to bring up before we get to the phones?
Can I just say it is that time of year that if you're sitting at home and wondering what to do with yourself,
yes,
if you'd like to join the academic crowd, we do have openings available for the spring semester. I will be teaching my infamous water chemistry course yet again. So if you'd like to be scared of the water that you drink and are surrounded by, please join in.
And you do a lot of studies, waterways and fecal matter and whatnot. Yeah?
I do, but I like to do it when it's not frozen, just because, you know, there's only so much you can do with frozen fecal matter.
By the way, if you got a pond nearby, what happens to all the little fishies when the pond freezes over?
Well, the actual oxygen levels can go up at that time of year as long as it's not completely iced over. And they adapt by shutting a lot of their systems down and just allowing a lot of diffusion to happen across their tissues. Mm-hmm. And they move their gills, same as some frogs will actually freeze solid and just be in a kind of a torpor, a hibernation at the bottom in the mud.
Frozen solid.
Mm-hmm. That's why you don't ever get really big frogs, because they need the oxygen to diffuse across their tissues.
I'll be darned. And, Jim, anything new that we should know about in your line of work?
No, I've been perusing the chemistry journals, and nothing too exciting.
All right.
One thing that I encountered that was interesting, one of the YouTube channels I subscribe to called Dr. Becky, which is very interesting on astrophysics.
Can you talk about this on the radio?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
Anyway, it's been in the news recently about a black hole that scientists can't explain because it's larger than it should be. It's something like 37 solar masses.
Where is this?
I don't know. But the thing
in space, we'll
in
just
space
say.
Somewhere.
Okay,
yes.
Fine.
That's Washington, D.C.
The real matter of this was the great headline of it being mysterious, impossible, can't be, was entirely fictitious in that there was really nothing untoward about this other than the fact that ones of that particular size had never been observed before. And it was kind of an analysis of how good science or how a good story goes rogue in this way with preposterous headlines.
But they
get repeated over and over again.
But the headline might be misleading, but is the actual story correct? In other words, you got to sell papers, right?
Yeah. I think more or less, other than the fact that, you know, scientists are baffled that because this is an impossible thing when, you know, it's not.
I got to tell you, the word baffled and scientist goes together a lot. I think when you take when you hear baffle, just scratch it out and write intrigued above it, because baffling
that.
Just sounds like you've given up. Like it's like, oh, I don't know.
Right.
But intrigued is like, huh.
I must look into
there's
this further.
Something here.
A true scientist is never baffled. They can always make up something that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it, I mean, it said that the great thing to say in, or great discoveries are made not by saying eureka, but by saying, wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, let's go to the phone. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum today. John in Rexford is first. John, you're on.
Yes, hello. I am vexed by static electricity here, so I get into a static torpor. I got two, couple pairs of shoes. One I wear, you know, pretty much most of the time for work, but I have another pair of shoes. I get a noticeable increase in static electricity with this other pair of shoes, and they're a little bit looser fitting, and I'm wondering, is there a scientific explanation why you would get zapped continuously with one pair of shoes versus another?
Sure, the soles on one of them is more conductive than the other, so it drains the static off.
Because there's definitely a difference. Whenever I get to the vehicle, I mean, I prove it over and over again, and just getting zapped continuously with this one pair of shoes versus the other one. So,
are you wearing Dutch wooden shoes by any chance?
No, just typical, like, insurance guy dress shoes. Nothing crazy.
And what kind of flooring do you have in your house before you go to the car or office, depending on where you're spending the most time?
The office is carpeted.
There you go.
Not only that, but if one is looser and you're wearing, for example, wool socks, then as your foot runs back and forth in the shoe, you can actually produce a static charge right there,
even without the flooring
even
being
without
polyester.
The flooring.
And that pair of shoes is looser, the shoes that I do get the most static from. So, okay, maybe that makes sense then.
Try a heavier pair of socks and see what happens.
Yeah, and not,
okay.
As Roger said, it could also it can be the way that the soles dissipate this charge, but different materials rubbing together will generate different electrical charges or generate them more or less. Well.
Now, if I wore copper shoes, let's say, or copper-soled shoes, that would be much more conductive, right?
Yeah,
right. You wouldn't get a static charge.
It wouldn't gather enough charge. You dissipate it all the time.
So matter of
fact,
then.
In clean rooms for semiconductor development, they put a strap on the bottom of your shoe that intentionally dissipates the static.
Yeah, I remember working on an electronics project once and actually having a
wrist strap
on the
wrist
when you're doing ICs and such and whatnot. Let's go to Greg in Pine Bush. Greg.
Hey there. I have about 20 chickens that I feed and water every day. Just this time of year, it's tough. I got to bring the watering can in every night, let it thaw, clean it out. I was wondering if there's anything I could add to water that is non-toxic that would be okay for the chickens to ingest, that would keep the water from freezing, essentially.
Interesting.
Well, for tonight's temperature, it's going to go too low for you to do that. But, yeah, anything that dissolves that isn't going to be truly salt, so you could use some sugars, for example, they wouldn't mind, like honey or syrup. What happens is your freezing point depression of water, you can move just by every molecule of stuff that you can dissolve into the water. Sugars and syrups don't dissolve well, but you can make them go in, I guess, if you used corn syrup, for example. That's relatively soluble. And, you know, the chickens don't mind the extra calories. The only thing you'd have to worry about is bacteria growing, even at cold temperatures. Huh.
Why wouldn't you just use the bowls that they use in a horse farm that are heated?
Well, I think you would have gotten that if you had electricity.
They have these pans.
I have a heat lamp for them.
Heat lamp.
But they have these pans. Like I have one on my bird bath outside that you just plug in, and it keeps it at 40 Fahrenheit, and therefore the ice never freezes.
And if you go to a good
like an Agway,
or tractor supply, they actually have heated buckets and heated bowls specifically for horses.
I would have suggested you put alcohol in it. But
you don't want to have alcohol evaporates out.
Yeah, right.
Loopy chickens, man.
Well, thanks, yeah, exactly. Greg. We appreciate the call.
Keeps the chickens warm as well.
So, I know you can change the boiling point on water by changing the pressure. Can you change the freeze point by changing the pressure?
You can by changing the pressure as well, but pressure doesn't really work if somebody's going to peck at the water. So
No, I get that, but you can move the freeze point with
absolutely.
Pressure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
But you need a lot of pressure.
Right. Okay. It's a lot easier to do it just by throwing in some solvent. Or some solute, rather, into the water. You can go down about to 20, 18. That's about it.
What about the chickens themselves? I mean, at what point do they just freeze up?
Well, it happens. I've had chickens, and you can lose a claw, you know, to frostbite, sure. And then it's time to harvest.
Let's see, if you were at my house, the chickens would be in the house with you.
You have chickens in the house?
No, we don't have chickens, but my wife would have the chickens in the house with us.
It makes sense.
Guy from Gelderland. 20 chickens showing up at Roger's house.
All right, fair enough. Let's take a break. That was an odd way to end the segment. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni will be back. Vox Pop, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551 and three or four emails here. All right, we'll get through these and then back to the phones. This one's from Mike in Hinsdale. My 12-year-old daughter asked me how the heck a little needle can drop down on a grooved piece of vinyl and all that rich music can come out. I don't know how to even begin to answer her. How do records actually work? And that's from Mike in Hinsdale.
Well, Mike.
Wow, that was a softball right across Roger's
plate. Yeah, really.
We gotta
send Mike a little gift, a hat or something.
Piece of vinyl.
Right, piece of vinyl. Well, I mean, it is an old science for sure. The records are cut via a cantilevered needle that is driven by a magnet, and the audio signals go into that magnet, and the dimension of the groove sets the volume of the playback. And interestingly enough, you actually have to compensate for the low frequencies and high frequencies, otherwise the grooves would be huge. It's called equalization. And the playback is just the reverse of that process. A needle falls in that and follows that groove and gives you the same excursions and generates a signal with a magnet. You're right in that it is next to reel-to-reel tape. It's the truest form of analog reproduction, but records wear out. That needle, that mechanical connection between the needle and the vinyl will wear over time.
Now, oddly enough, my 10-year-old daughter was reading a book on Edison. When they first did this, just using they didn't need magnets to do this, right? They did it with mechanical.
Right.
And so how did that work?
Yeah. So I have a Victrola. Actually, I have a couple of Victrolas at home. And that vibrating needle just drives a diaphragm. And then they used a mechanical horn. It was at the end of a horn, like a funnel. And that it increased the air velocity as it went out over in the larger volume of the horn. Or actually decreased the velocity, increased the pressure. It reproduced the sound. The way you changed the volume was you opened and closed the doors to block the horn.
The Edison cylinders.
Wax. They were wax.
And I remember seeing some very old wax platters, very thick. But these cylinders, they worked the same way, right?
Absolutely.
The needle just went along the grooves, but it was on a cylinder.
Interestingly enough, sir.
It's like a Pillsbury Doughboy roll of rolls.
Yeah.
It's about that same size, but
Syracuse University has one of the largest collections of wax cylinder recordings in the world.
Any advantages fidelity-wise to having a cylinder over a platter?
No, but if I can, the big thing that the cylinders had was that the needle, because it was always going around the same distance, the needle actually followed a groove outside of the cylinder so that it always went the same speed along the cylinder. And as a result, you could not scratch the instrument.
I'll be darned.
One of the biggest challenges in turntable design is the change in the radius of the as the needle as the music plays and the arm follows the record in,
yeah,
you're not tangential to the groove any longer, where the cylinder eliminates that. So there is some interesting.
And they had linear tracking arms as well. And is that a similar idea to the cylinder?
It was very similar.
Well, when the records are actually made, they're made with a linear tracking device. So if you play it back with linear tracking, you get rid of all the effects of the radial changes.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
One of the guys in the newsroom has a very nice linear tracking. It's a German. Can't get parts for it. The sensors don't work right. It's driving them crazy. Ah, that's right, Lucas Willard. We're talking about you. This is from Tana in Cooperstown. How can I increase humidity in my 650-square-foot home without a humidifier? If I put bowls of water out, is there a formula for how many square inches or feet of water surface do I need? Night temperature is 55. Daytime is 64. I'd love some direction. And that's from Tana in Cooperstown.
I think a lot of it depends on what heating source you're using. If you're using a fire, if you've got a stove, then put something up on the top that produces steam from that. That makes it really easy. But if you're using a baseboard heat, for example, then a humidifier is probably the best way to go.
Well, actually, I'll give you one piece from the family, the non-scientific family.
Yeah.
And what my great aunt did is bought a old crock pot, brand name. But anyway, an old crock pot at the dollar store, at the Salvation Army type of thrift store, and then leaves it on low with distilled water in it. And that always is there. And then every morning she just adds a little bit. And low setting on the non-name brand crock pot really does the trick, and it keeps it really nice in there.
The trick of the trick is you got to vaporize the water. If you just set the water out, eventually it will evaporate, but the process is so long, it's not likely to change the humidity in the room.
Especially when we have cold temperatures like this, where the air just, outside air, won't hold any moisture. You're not getting any help. You're getting actually the moisture sucked from the house from the outside air.
And to the point about the heat source, if you had forced air heat, putting the pans of water right in front of the where the air comes out
would be all right.
Would cause the water to evaporate a little more quickly.
Why the aversion to the humidifier? I mean, they're very effective. Obviously, she can't answer us, but she obviously has an aversion to using a humidifier. There are ultrasonic humidifiers out there if she doesn't like the concept of heating it.
I think the real big trick is that no matter what you use, you want to use distilled water or at least soft water if you can. Because as the water evaporates, the calcium comes out and starts forming a god-awful mess. Ultrasonic humidifiers, the white smoke that comes out of an ultrasonic humidifier, effectively that's calcium that's coming out of the water.
Wow.
So you want to use, if you can, use RO water or distilled water.
You know, what I use is the condensate from my furnace.
Yeah.
I collect that in a bucket.
Just one more cautionary tale, though, is that you need to check it regularly, especially the filters for bacteria, and change the filters religiously.
Like a CPAP.
Just like a Brita filter or anything else in your house, there are waterborne bacteria that love that kind of environment, and like Legionnaire's disease.
Yeah.
So you don't want Legionella getting hold. And that just all that is just preventive maintenance. There's nothing special that you have to do.
We don't use any humidifiers, and our house, you know, we have radiators, and it tends to get pretty dry. And I notice, getting back to our first caller, about increased static electricity in my house,
it's all related.
Completely.
Because of the dryness?
Sure,
yes.
Because the water, when you have moisture, it bleeds off the static charge.
Yep. Oh.
So, again, to go back to a clean room analogy, we always keep the humidity at a certain level, so it bleeds off any static discharge.
I have to be very careful about touching electronics when I get up from the couch, because that is behind where the radiator is behind there, so I have to go and touch the implements for the fireplace, which are metal to throw the charge out.
When I was a kid, we grew up with steam heat, and which have radiators, but they bleed the steam off into the room, and it never got dry in the house.
Ah, that's good. This one, last email, and then we'll get back to the phones. This is from Rich. It's a rather long email, but we'll do our best. The Rich writes, I have these devices, a 10x50 Nikon binoculars, C90 spotting scope, about 5-inch lens, 8-inch Orion reflector telescope. I have always heard that bigger aperture means more light gathering ability. My assumption has been that more light gathering means brighter, more detailed images. I look at the Orion Nebula M42 with these devices. It appears brightest in the binoculars, less bright in the C90, least bright in the big scope. Don't seem to see any detail, just a washed-out dim cloud. Why? The most pleasant view is from the cheap, low-power binoculars.
I don't have an answer other than the larger the aperture, the more energy you collect. That is accurate.
This would be one for Bob Berman.
Well, it would, but, you know, I have to say, too, as a binocular fan, not an expert, you really get what you pay for. And, you know, a Nikon 10x50 is not exactly a cheap binocular, but I'm not sure about the spot.
An 8-inch reflector is pretty substantial.
Well, it is, but how expensive is that 8-inch reflector? So I think the price that you pay really does give you the quality, usually.
Yeah, there's also a difference between reflectors and refractors. Refractors, which such as the binoculars, tend to make a much cleaner image than the reflector. And the reflector tends to make a much more diffuse image. It may be brighter, but it's more diffuse if it's not adjusted exactly right.
All right. Well, I think we will, Richard, ask you to call back or write in again when we do our astronomy show with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And I know Bob has discussed this in the past. So then we'll jump back on the phones at 800-348-2551 and go to Ryan in Malta. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, folks. I was talking with some friends the other day about our dream jobs, and my dream job would be it's in recycling, but I would love to be able to recycle tires cleanly, and it seems to be part of the holy grail of recycling. What can you tell me about devulcanization, and what is the best way? Canada has done a lot of research on it, but no one's doing it, it seems.
Well, I know they make a lot of indoor riding rink, horse rinks, and so forth with ground up tires. I don't know about devulcanizing.
In fact, a number of papers crossed my desk in my job as journal editor about devulcanization of rubber, and it just doesn't seem to be the chemistry is not real good.
What's the best practice for doing it?
Tell you the truth, I don't know. It's a matter of rubber is vulcanized by making bonds across the carbon chains of the rubber with sulfur atoms. Sometimes it's just one sulfur atom, and sometimes it's a bunch of sulfur atoms.
Yeah.
When it's a bunch of sulfur atoms, those are easy to break. And you can devulcanize that. The ones that are just one sulfur atom, it's much harder to break that and separate the chains and devulcanize the
rubber. What's the result? What do you have left over when you devulcanize it?
Well, you end up with the chains that have some sulfurs hanging off, but the sulfurs hanging off, that's okay. Because what you want to do is convert it from being a thermoset in which the chains are... Imagine a pot of spaghetti when it's...
You had me at spaghetti. Go ahead.
When it's fresh.
Yep.
And it flows, right?
Yeah.
All those spaghetti chains flow past each other versus cold spaghetti in the bowl in which the chains are stuck together.
Ah.
And then you've got this rubbery mass.
Yes.
That won't go anywhere. What you want to do is break those points where it's stuck together.
Right.
With rubber, it's stuck together with sulfur.
What do you wind up with as a product? Devulcanized?
Oh, you end up then with the liquid rubber back again that you can reform into a different shape.
As opposed to burn it, which is what you do if you can't break it up.
So there is some technology, I believe, that's practiced, but it's not really good because it's very difficult to break those bonds when there's just the one sulfur. It's easy to break a sulfur-sulfur bond, but hard to break a carbon-sulfur bond.
It's interesting because microbiology does some of that carbon-sulfur bond breaking. There are whole classes of bacteria that are sulfide reducers that do that job. Hmm. So I'm thinking that biotechnology has a theoretical opportunity here to find either one bacterium or a population of different bacteria that can cut both the disulfide bonds, the polysulfide bonds, and then the monosulfide bonds.
Oh,
that would be
but
great.
But if that ever gets out in the environment, the tires start to dissolve on your car.
Yes, it would be. It'd be Soylent Green or something.
Oh, boy.
It?
Ryan, thank you for a very interesting one. Now, next time we make spaghetti in my house, I'll say, hey, this is totally vulcanized. Exactly. You know?
Can you devulcanize spaghetti? That's my question.
Well, we'll yes,
that's
you can.
Your homework.
Again, with bacteria.
Ah.
All right, back to the phones we go here, and we go to Alan in Beckett, Mass. Alan, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about the use of a radiometer in terms of generating power. Are you familiar with the radiometer?
Of course, yes.
Okay. You know, the fact I'm a retired teacher, and you had one, you know, sort of a toy one in my classroom where for the listeners, it spins based upon the sun hitting it with black, and actually the definition is a device containing a set of veins, like wind veins, that are blackened on one side and suspended and white on the other and suspended on an axis in a vacuum. The veins rotate on exposure to sunlight. So I was just wondering if you can picture that now of something when the sun hits it spinning, something like that used in, let's say, an area that has deserts, a huge ones to generate power.
Hmm.
Has that been used at all? Are you familiar with that at all?
Just remember conservation of energy.
Well, the problem is that the radiometer generates enough power just about to turn itself. It only barely works. The way that you could generate electricity in a desert like that, and may actually be done in some places, is basically you set up large greenhouse areas to heat up the air and then run that through a chimney with an air turbine in it.
Ah, yeah.
And you can generate power that way. But the radiometer itself generates enough torque basically just to turn itself.
Yeah, and there's a problem with the friction of the system.
Yeah.
I mean, a radiometer has to be in a vacuum. It has to be a knife point at the top to allow it to spin. And as you make it bigger to make it worth something, the friction of the system would increase, and the problems associated with trying to make the thing work would go up as well.
Yeah.
Even the convection fans that you put on top of, the unplugged ones that you put on top of a wood stove that are supposed to push that wood stove air out to you, I think it's placebo effect that people just feel the air because there really is no force behind that.
Just remember conservation of energy. You've got to collect more energy than you want to turn into electricity.
Well, Alan, for that. But what if you used space-age, very lightweight, strong materials and, as Alan says, use large surface area for this thing? Reduce the friction as best you can. It still isn't a viable.
You'd be much better off using a photovoltaic panel.
Photons don't have a lot of mass.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Because
every time you convert it from one type of energy to another, you have losses. Right, so just go right from the source to the sink where you want it.
All right. Let's go to Dominic in Schenectady. Dominic.
Yes, I have a fundamental question going back to high school physics. Does the gravitational constant prove is a function of the amount of matter in the universe, proving that we live in a bubble because the universe is infinite, and for the gravitational constant, gravitational constant must prove that we live in a bubble?
I saw a piece on this the other day, actually.
I don't think so. The gravitational constant just sort of is what it is. The proportionality.
They arrived at that by taking the two masses and measuring the force.
Yeah, you do exactly. It's determined experimentally.
Right.
And I don't think it really has anything to do with the surrounding universe.
Now the interesting question is does the gravitational constant change in other portions of the universe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, the indication would be certainly not in the observable universe.
The problem is there's no understanding of the force of gravity.
No, there is.
Yeah, the gravitational constant, big G, can be determined experimentally and was a couple hundred years ago.
What I've heard around this table a few times, though, is we don't understand if it's changed with respect to time. If we look at the blip that we're in now as a modern civilization, 60,000 years or whatever the number is these days, and we look at what percent of expansion of the universe must have happened in that 60,000 years, it's really background rate noise, really. So if G has changed in that 60,000 years, we have no frame of reference to know if it's changing with respect to time on the universe scale versus our civilization scale. For our intents and purposes, it's constant.
Yeah, there's always the possibility that there's scale factors that physicists cannot work with right now. In fact, one of the big questions in the universe is there dark matter is effectively a outshoot of the question of whether gravity changes as a function of size.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, thank you.
The answer is you got to wait and find out.
The force changes for sure. GMM over R squared. So the force does change as a function of size.
Now let's take a break here because I frankly have no idea what they're talking about, but I'm just the host and I'll give you the number 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Science. More of it coming up. Science Forum today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni here. And we'll jump back on the phones. A very interesting question from Tom via email. How does a guitar work? Let's send it over to the guy who plays the glasses, Ed Stander.
How does a guitar work? It's sort of like a record. What happens is you pluck a string, the string vibrates, the vibration length of the string and the mass of the string determines the vibration. So you tune the string to whatever note you want, and then when you press it down, you're changing the length of the string. When you change the length of the string, you get a different frequency, and that's your note. That then affects the bridge of the guitar, the bottom part of the guitar, and that makes the bridge move laterally towards the string and away from it. And then that vibration going back and forth then moves the piece of wood that the bridge is on, and that amplifies the sound so that you effectively are, for the guitar is effectively a large amplifier. The sound just then vibrates through the instrument and also comes out the sound hole.
Okay. How does banjo work? The answer? Well below union scale. There you go. You see,
back you know, to... you know, you can tell a banjo player is out of tune?
How?
His fingers are moving.
What do you say to a banjo player in a suit and tie?
What?
Will the defendant please rise? Let's go to Doug in Albany. Doug, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about deuterium. How do you create deuterium depleted water at home?
Deuterium.
Can you use silent to do it?
Okay. Anybody want to field this one?
No.
At home? Wow.
No, I don't think you can.
Unless your home is in a really good lab, I think you're done.
Well, they use
Why would you want to make deuterium depleted water?
Deuterium's not.
Deuterium doesn't do anything.
It doesn't
bad.
Do anything bad to you. It's got a neutron. That's it. It's not radioactive.
It's poisonous, correct?
No.
Well, not at all.
Yes, it is.
It would be if you drank pure D2O. Pure deuterium water.
But you can't.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the audience what deuterium is?
Deuterium is just like a hydrogen atom, but with an extra neutron in the nucleus. So it has a higher atomic mass.
It's fat-bottomed hydrogen.
Yeah. It vibrates. When a bond made to deuterium vibrates more slowly than a more commonly known as heavy water. So it does affect biochemistry. But the tiny, teeny, tiny amount of deuterium that's in water that you drink, well, for one thing, you've evolved to be able to handle that. And it's not enough to affect your biochemistry.
Okay.
So but it's created with electrolysis, correct?
No, it's not created that way.
No, you can separate it by centrifugation, by spinning it, or electrolysis.
Yeah, the way it's generally done is by electrolyzing water, or just repeatedly boiling water will concentrate deuterium.
But a great movie, if you ever get a chance to watch, is the Nazis were working on an atomic weapon project. And the Norwegians, I think, were using deuterium for fertilizer. Is that correct?
Something like that. I remember.
But it was something related to agriculture.
Yeah.
And they had a plant, and the Allies wrecked the plant.
But anyway, you can't deplete the deuterium at home, and there's no reason to.
Doug, what are you going to do with it?
There are health benefits by drinking depleted deuterium depleted water.
No, there are not.
Okay.
Agreed.
Our chemist and biologist say no, so well, thank you for the call,
emphatically,
Doug.
Emphatically, no.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Interesting program to some extent. Shauna in Shauna, where are you calling from?
From Alplaus.
Alplaus, you're on.
I don't know. Where is Alplaus?
It's near Rexford.
Thank you. I have an electric tea kettle with a blue light, and there was a box on the counter, and the shadow of the box on the white counter was yellow in the blue light. So I'm wondering, why would a blue light cast a yellow shadow?
Because the blue light was giving out quite a bit of light in the ultraviolet, and what you are probably seeing is the white of the box probably had whiteners in it, and the whiteners actually show up under ultraviolet light.
Ah.
So the box was glowing just a bit.
Cool.
It's the same reason why if you use certain types of fabric softeners or detergents, your clothes look whiter. And they look whiter simply because they're giving off whiteners in the ultraviolet that you're picking up.
What if the box wasn't white?
Okay. It can also be a matter that the blue light that's surrounding the shadow, because of the way your eye would compensate things, will make then the shadow look the complementary color, which will be yellow.
If you stare at it.
And I was going to actually suggest something different, and that is that the light that she sees is blue is also putting out energy in the yellow range, and the reflective color, the box is printed with an ink that reflects more yellow than the blue, and therefore she was seeing a yellow.
Chances are the blue LED was just blue.
Yeah.
And
blue LEDs.
If they're LEDs.
Yeah, my bet would be that it's having to do with an optical effect in your eye, that it's an optical illusion.
Speaking of that, why were blue LEDs tough to make? Thank you for the call, Shauna. Back in the day, you couldn't get a blue LED. Now you can get them.
Yeah, they crept up on the LEDs from the... Okay, a blue LED, the light that's being produced is higher energy, and it was probably just harder to get the solid state chemistry there right, because they snuck up on LEDs from the infrared end.
There
were infrared LEDs and then reds and then yellows and greens. And
it's so funny now. Is that why the Christmas lights? Now, for several years now, I've been trying to save money because my house is like Santa's workshop. Okay, there's colored lights everywhere. And I've been buying the LED lights, and it saves a lot of money. But the early ones, especially, the blues would blow out.
Oh, and the flicker, too, from the blue lights was really
horrible. Much better now, though. Yeah, they seem to have improved it.
One of the biggest problems with LEDs is heat dissipation. If the LED is not well set up to get rid of the heat that it's producing, it'll tend to blow out much faster. Mm. And that's, for example, why you shouldn't be using LEDs in enclosed lights on your ceiling, for example, because they heat up too much and then they blow much faster.
Ah.
And the blue lights actually give off more heat than the red and yellow.
You know what
lights.
I am on the Christmas tree. You can touch them. They don't feel hot at all. They're nice and cool.
Well, that's because they're dissipating heat properly.
Yeah, the down on the little tiny spot very deep inside where the light's actually being generated, that does get pretty hot. Hmm. It's just, you know, when you're touching it fairly far away and through that big mass, then.
Well, the tree hasn't burned down yet, so we're in pretty good shape. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. John and Oneonta. John, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to add something, a method to add increase the relative humidity in a home is just depend on evapotranspiration. Bring in a lot of plants. You probably have a lot in the house already. And, for example, a large tree can transpire 100 gallons of water a day, even if you only get a gallon out of the plants that are in a well-stocked room. you know, watering them every day, you get moisture in the air. You don't have to worry about any calcium compounds going into the air and creating white dust that lands
on
anything.
None of us thought of that.
You don't need the device.
I feel somehow that I should have thought of that.
And I'm going to resign my seat as a result.
I thought of it, but I didn't want to say it.
Oh, sure. Come on.
The geologist says
saving
that.
It for John. John, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And now we go over to Pete in Albany. Hello, Pete.
Good afternoon. What great questions you guys are getting today. They're really interesting.
I know. Isn't that rare?
They're thought-provoking. I'm still hung up on this deuterium-free water, but
oh, yeah,
besides
man.
That, you know the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey when he had that giant round space station and the guy's running around it. You know, he's running around the inside of the space station. How much gravity and how big does something have to be and how fast it has to be spinning in order to make the guy feel the same weight as he would on Earth?
Well, you understand, first of all, it's not gravity.
Right. It's a simulation sort of, right?
It's a centrifugal force.
Right.
You're being forced over towards the edge.
We've seen this in movies. I mean, you go back to early 60s and 50s. They have these ring satellites spinning around.
Right.
What's the thought process behind this?
Well, it's centrifugal force, so it's
you actually have to be touching the outside in order to get that
right.
force? Or
well,
you do.
You will be touching it no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have any choice. You'd be up against it. I don't know what's the practicalities involved in this is that you could produce that gravity with a ring of any, or that force with a ring of almost any size. The problem being that if the ring is fairly small, then the force on your head is different from it is on your feet enough to get disoriented. So, in for example, the one that was on in 2001 on the actual spaceship, that would have been too small to be practical from what I've read. So you probably need to be, I don't know, 20, 30 meters or so in diameter to make
where
it work.
Your height becomes inconsequential,
yeah.
You're saying.
Maybe more.
It's not that big.
And then it's just a matter of you dial in how much force you want by how fast it revolves.
By the rotational. Yep.
There's another part to it as well, and that is in order to get a good centrifugal force, you have to have a relatively high speed if it's small. And anybody who's ever been on one of those horrible rides at an amusement park knows very
the
well.
The tilt-a-whirl.
The vomit comet.
Yes, the vomit comet. You've got to go really relatively fast in order to be pushed against the wall because it's acceleration towards the outside. If it's a larger ring, you can go slower. So the smaller the ring, the faster you have to go.
So like this, the space station in 2001, that would be easy to generate realistic feeling artificial gravity. The one in which he was running around in the spacecraft, that was not entirely realistic.
Okay, and what is it about those tilt-a-whirls? By the way, let's ask the biologist about this. You know, I haven't been on one in 40 years. My kids have no problem. If I went on one today, it would not go well. Why is it you age and then you can't do that thing?
You start having problems with semicircular canals in your
ears.
Right,
your vestibular system in your ears is aged considerably more than your children.
Yeah.
So that's why you don't see vertigo in small children. You see vertigo in middle-aged women and men.
Yeah.
And then sometimes older men and women. And that's all of a kind of kaflooey of the vestibular system. So you've got an X-axis, a Y-axis, and a Z-axis in your head, so three dimensionals, and you have sloshing of fluid. What happens is there's little pieces of crystal that are in that fluid, and that slosh factor of the crystals in the fluid is what gives your brain the input of what direction you're moving. Well, those crystals can grow or they can shatter, and when that happens, then the feedback that you get to your brain is different. Your brain doesn't know what to do.
You get that positional vertigo, which is so much fun.
Oh,
yes.
I hear you want to die if you have it.
It's interesting. It's very interesting.
So, chickens will get it if you give them alcohol.
And now we're back full circle, just like we're on 2001, The Space Odyssey. Jerry in Cambridge. Jerry.
Hi. I wonder whether you folks would comment on Darwinianism at this time. We are grateful for a contribution of evolution, but the language of survival of the fittest may need tailoring at this juncture, because we see in the plant world the relationship of plants to fungal growth, which sometimes acts as community. And in the case of diseased growing material, diseased tree, for example, in an orchard, we see fungal progress toward the diseased member to give it more nutrients. It's as though it were nearly altruistic. Has to watch the language, but maybe someone could comment.
Well, we have
on
a biologist here who can probably talk about that. Sure.
Okay, so I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks.
So evolutionary biology, as it's called in the field, it has evolved a lot since the writings of Darwin more than 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. The idea of survival of the fittest is great for a bumper sticker, but it certainly does not encapsulate all of what we know for evolution. So one of the basic tenets of evolutionary biology is adaptation. And adaptation does include community relationships between different species, different kingdoms even. Like, as you mentioned, fungal and plant biology go hand in hand. If it weren't for the rhizomes and the microbiome of a plant, then a plant would not be able to fix nitrogen in order to grow, let alone survive. So these webs of biology that come together are constantly changing. And I would say more than fitness, we look at adaptation to the environment. Animals or plants that fail to thrive in the current circumstances are ones that cannot adapt to the environmental changes that happen too quickly.
All right, very good. Now back to the phones and Phil in South Hadley. Phil, you got about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. Black holes we hear about all the time. Does anyone have a simple explanation as to what they are? And do they go away? Do they just continue to exist? And I'll hang up and appreciate the call. Thank you.
Splendid. We have 1 minute, panel, so go to town.
1 minute.
Black holes are places where there's matter has been compressed enough so that the space around it is warped and nothing, not even light, can escape. So you can have black holes that have masses that are, say, three times that of the sun. There's enough gravity then for it to collapse down and nothing can escape, and it's a black hole.
Yeah.
It's possible to have smaller black holes if there was enough pressure to push the matter together small enough bit. As far as the permanence, for all practical purposes, they're permanent. They do slowly essentially evaporate away by something called Hawking radiation, but that requires gazillions of billions of years to happen.
And that suggests two things. First of all, there is some evidence that black holes hit black holes.
Yep.
And when a black hole hits a black hole, then they can both disappear. They can both break up.
Okay.
And the second thing is
they make a new black hole.
At times, any number of things can happen. We're not quite sure what happens.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. But thank you to the panel very much for being here today. Support comes from 10,000 Villages, offering handcrafted global gifts for the holidays, available in store and online. 10,000villages.com. Berkshire Bird Paradise, Petersburg, New York, accepting donations for their bird sanctuary and gardens for injured and disabled birds, birdparadise.org. At Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, featuring holiday shopping, barbecue, craft beer, coffee, art by James Terrell, Laurie Anderson, and Titus Kapfer. Mass Mocha, it's more than a museum. MassMocha.org. Well, once again, thanks to the panel today, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni for being here. Thank you for listening. Really, really great calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. It says Jim Morrison, but it's Jim Harrison, right? Jim Morrison was a lizard king. That's not you, right? No riding on the storm or anything? Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh, forget about it. Rocco DeFazio joins us for an Italian Christmas Food Friday extravaganza. Oh, yeah, get out the Alka-Seltzer. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.